This is the Jeff Merrick Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
You know, I swear to you, I really don't think anybody wants that last wild card spot in the Eastern Conference. I really, really don't. And there was a time last night where it looked like, whether it was the Islanders or the Penguins and the Washington Capitals, we had a very, very lifeless performance last night. All of them were losing. And it was not looking good. And you say to yourself, does anybody really want the second wild card spot? It's sitting right there. If you want it, go for it. Grab it. Any team want to distinguish themselves, go for it. There is an absolutely huge game, by the way, tomorrow. Pittsburgh and Washington. And yes, suddenly, somehow, the Pittsburgh Penguins have kind of dragged themselves back into this thing. We're going to talk a lot about the wild card race specifically for that spot coming up in a couple of moments here. Shannon Goldman from the Too Many Men podcast and also The Athletic will stop by. Don Waddell will be here, Carolina Hurricanes president and general manager. A few things to get in here with the GM of the Hurricanes. One, Seth Jarvis. We've been talking a lot lately on this program and elsewhere about the most improved player in the NHL. Seth Jarvis is right up near or at the top of the many people's lists in the next unofficial award in the NHL. We'll get his thoughts on the Carolina Hurricanes. Certainly also, since he was a general manager there, we should probably get his thoughts on Atlanta as a potential future market in the NHL again. And it is Wednesday. That means it's time for MVSW Redux with Greg Wyshynski from ESPN and the Drop Podcast. And then we'll open up the segment at the bottom of hour two with Matt Marchese. Topics are wide open for that one. In the meantime, wanted to play a clip from you, for you from last night. Now, it wasn't the best of all possible performances by the Vancouver Canucks last night, or you can look at it and say, wow, what a great performance by the Vegas Golden Knights, and who wants to go anywhere near them come playoff time? Personally, as an aside, I don't want to play anybody in the Western Conference, thank you very much. But anyway, you know how managers are and coaches and players and anybody really are so shy about using the R word, rebuild? You know, it's always interesting to hear managers dance around that word. Some don't mind it. Like Daniel Briere, GM of the Philadelphia Flyers, does not mind saying the word rebuild. Other managers don't like that, and the associations and connotations that come along with it. They will dance around at these little semantic dances to go out of their way to make sure they never say the word rebuild. And it is also very interesting to hear coaches, although we heard John Tortorella use this word this week, dance around to try not to use the word soft. As we talked about with Elliot yesterday, who was reminded by Glenn Healy of the NHL alumni now years ago, the worst thing you can call a hockey player or a collection of hockey players is soft. So what do you do when you want to call your team's performance soft, but at the same time, you don't want to call your team's performance soft? Have a listen to this. This is Rick Tocchet's masterclass on not using the word soft when describing his Vancouver Canucks last night.
I know you've been kind of sounding the alarm for a while about finding another level. And in some of the games where the team hasn't been at its best, it defended really well.
Yeah.
Didn't give up much. But, you know, the playoffs are around the corner now.
Yeah.
Is it starting to become a concern that the team is still clearly well below where it needs to be?
I think as an individual, you look at your game, you know, and how can I play better? You know, what can I do to contribute to the team? If everybody does that, you know, you hope the next game will improve on that. Because, you know, like I said, you know, some guys got to look at their shifts and, you know, what can I do different to help the team? You know, we know the system, obviously, but then it comes to, you know, there's a penalty kill. Can we be a little bit more aggressive on the wall to get that thing out? I think we were a little light getting in there. I just thought we were a little light everywhere. And that's not the type of game you want when you're getting a stretch drive. So we got to find it quickly.
A little bit light everywhere. Not to be confused with soft. Don't want to call anybody soft. We know what comes along with those connotations. Let's just choose the word light. A little bit light everywhere. Not soft, just light. Again, Don Waddell coming up bottom of the hour. I thought that was pretty interesting from last night. Tough performance by the Vancouver Canucks. That game against the Arizona Coyotes is going to be a pretty important one here. Greg Wyshynski coming up at the top of hour two. Matt Marchese at the bottom of said hour as well. In the meantime, we welcome aboard once again, no stranger to these parts. She's about to make all of us smarter, starting with me. She is Shannon Goldman, part of the trio that is the Too Many Men podcast and also from The Athletic. Good afternoon, Shana Goldman.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for pumping my tires before we even get started.
Well, I mean, I like to keep the bar raised high around you, but then listen, like I have this sort of, the bar is so low around me as far as educating anybody. I tend to try just to make hockey sounds for a couple of hours and then rely on people like you to actually educate, or Kevin Woodley yesterday to help educate people. But nonetheless, thanks as always for stopping by. A few things I want to get into with you here to kick off the program. And one, I want to kind of go sort of off hockey script, although there is a definite, you know, hockey connotation to this one. And I retweeted it this morning. It's Ted Leonsis. Now, Ted is, of course, the owner of the Washington Capitals for hockey purposes. And Ted Leonsis talks about wanting to turn Washington into the capital of women's professional sports. Now, we know that he's very interested in a PWHL team, as are other markets. Pittsburgh comes to mind, Detroit, Fenway Sports, who owns the Pittsburgh Penguins and Red Sox, etc. They've always wanted a PWHL team. That's not exactly a secret. And one of the takeaways from this interview on CNBC with Ted Leonsis is he says, it's certainly the growth stock right now, women's sports. When you look at the future of women's sports, I mean, right now, in a lot of ways, it's still in its infancy in a lot of sort of, in a lot of by way of growth potential. The sky is certainly the limit for it. When you hear someone like Ted Leonsis, who's run, you know, a number of successful sports franchises, talk about the growth stock right now being women's sports, and then dovetailing that by talking about wanting to bring a professional women's hockey team to DC, what goes through your mind?
I think he's a smart businessman, because if you are in the business of sports right now, you should be investing in women's sports. You know, there's a ton of room for growth. And I think we're seeing every day a little bit more interest in it. Look at, you know, the March Madness tournaments, right? We're not talking about the men's. Yep. We're talking about the women. We are all tuned in the other night for LSU against Iowa. There was a full slate of NHL games. And how many of us NHL reporters made sure to have that on a screen? I know I did. And I don't like basketball at all. Women's sports is growing leaps and bounds right now. So you should want to be investing. And if you can at the grassroots level, and you can, you know, at the beginning of something like the PWHL, why not, right? We've all been waiting for this moment, mm-hmm. one league for everyone. And we see the success that we're having. Jump in and be a part of it and help get it to an even bigger place than maybe we thought it could have originally gone. So I think it's a very smart investment, especially if we see teams in, you know, Pittsburgh and Philly and areas like that, to have budding rivalries with Washington. Like, that's something we could all want to see.
For sure. Like, I don't know that the PWHL is in sort of growth mode right now, but I think we certainly see the destinations. And I think, like, look, Leonsis knows what he's doing when he even just sort of casually throws that out there, because that's just chum, right? That's chum for the Sharks. It's like, okay, all of a sudden, let's make sure that while we're talking about, you know, Fenway Sports, we're talking about, you know, markets like Detroit, etc., that we keep the Washington market very much in the conversation for the PWHL. Okay, speaking of Washington, I'm not convinced that they want this playoff spot, are you?
I'm not convinced anybody wants this playoff spot. Like, what is happening? You know what? The one thing we can take away from this is anybody that says they want to expand the playoffs, no, you don't, because these games are so important right now. You look at last night's slate, how many of us were tuned into Buffalo, Washington, and Pittsburgh, New Jersey to see what's going on in the Eastern Conference race? And how many people were watching the Islanders, Blackhawks, which generally, I mean, everyone wants to see Bedard, but are we tuning in when the Blackhawks are playing as much this year? Probably not. But, you know, we all want to see where things are going.
Yeah. We do. And last night, things went horribly for the Washington Capitals from pretty much the get-go. This was the, you know, Jeff Skinner game number 1,000, and congratulations to him. J.J. Paterka, who now takes that spot that Skinner used to occupy, became the star of the show yesterday for the Buffalo Sabres. You know, Terry Pegula's in attendance, see him there with Kevin Adams, etc. And it just seemed that, like, right off the hop, this team, like this Washington Capitals team, just wasn't there. They were just absent. Like, the one thing about Washington, and we always sort of focus in on the goal differential for this team, and it is abysmal. Let me call it up here really quickly. Washington Capitals are at a -35 goal differential. And I look at the Capitals and I say, this is a team that when they win, they'll win by like one goal, maybe two. But Shayna, when they lose big. And they lost big last night, getting doubled up by the Buffalo Sabres. It's almost as if it's a team that says, eh, you know what? We're not feeling it today. Let's just throw in the towel. Does it feel the same way like that to you?
Yeah, it's so inconsistent. And that's the thing. These losses aren't one-goal losses or overtime losses. We are seeing them get absolutely hammered in their losses. And that really does contribute to their negative goal differential. Yeah. And, you know, I know that there's been a lot made of it this season. And sometimes we're all rolling our eyes the second you hear the word goal differential. But there's a reason for it, because you go through the salary cap era and you look at how many teams made it to the playoffs with that negative of a goal differential. First of all, there are none. The worst was the Florida Panthers. I think it was in 2011, 2012. And their goal differential was like minus 24, which is not negative 35. Big difference there. Yeah. They usually don't get out of round one. There's exceptions. Montreal Canadiens have been that exception a couple times, and COVID years had something to do with it as well. But, you know, it's a red flag. And then you see the way that they're losing games and you see why there's that red flag. And, you know, to their credit, since they've been turning things around, you see when their playoff odds started to jump up in the month of March and, you know, parts of February, you saw that their goal differential was closer to a neutral. I think after last night's game, it's probably like negative one, negative two, but the other day it was a positive two. So, you know, it changes every game.
Yeah.
And you're seeing it's better now, but there's still those inconsistencies. And last night showed you that, when that was a game that they probably should have won.
It was. Let me ask you about a couple of things here. I'm just going to sort of bounce around in as many different places as we can, because that's the wonderful thing about having you on. We can go a lot of different spots here. And I want to circle back to something that you were talking about on the Too Many Men podcast, coming off the general manager's meetings. But let's bracket that for 1 second and circle back to it. Where are you at on fighting in the NHL?
I feel like it's up this year. I have not checked the numbers, but I was thinking about this the other day. I do feel like it's on the rise here. I feel like we're seeing it a little bit more often. For me, do I care for it that much? No. It's there. It exists. It's a part of the game. And there's rightfully penalties that get associated with it. My biggest qualm with it, if I had to pick anything, isn't the fighting itself. It's the fighting after clean hits is one thing that just grinds my gears every day of the week. Because we say we want hitting in hockey, right? Nobody wants hockey to be soft or anything like that. You hear it constantly, right? If you say, oh, that was a dirty hit, that shouldn't be in the game, then immediately you want the game soft. But when you have fights after clean hits, it kind of takes away the argument for clean hits in hockey. If that's what has to happen every time, if you want hitting in hockey, it doesn't need to immediately be associated with a fight, in my opinion. So that's where my brain goes first when we talk about fights.
Okay, so let me ask you about fights after dirty hits then. And tonight is going to be the New York Rangers and the New Jersey Devils. Anything to this game tonight? Let me think about what this might mean. Matt Rempe wasn't out for extra work after the skate. Sounds like he's in the lineup tonight. And it sounds like, as he was inching closer all week and last week as well, to getting back in the lineup, Curtis McDermott will be in there for the New Jersey Devils. We all know what the score is here. We all know why these two will be in the lineup and will find shared ice tonight. And I think that, you know, I'd be very surprised if Matt Rempe is quote unquote under orders not to fight tonight against Curtis McDermott. But these would be in responses to this. This fight specifically would be in response to both the Nathan Bastian and the Jonas Siegenthaler hit. Both were hits that were penalized. One, we saw a suspension for the hits. Does that fall under the same category of fights after hits for you? Or is it more palatable after it's a dirty hit, even if it is weeks after the initial hits?
I think it's more palatable after a dirty hit. You kind of expect that, right? And everybody says it. If you don't do it, then you're like, we go back to this. If you don't fight after a dirty hit, then you're definitely soft. Like, there's not a maybe you are. Then you absolutely positively are. And you're not meant for the men's game and all of that, right? But weeks after, I don't love. I don't love things that get drawn out or premeditated. And here's the other part of it. The Devils' decision to play Curtis McDermott at its core is not a good one for the Devils. If Curtis McDermott was someone who made the Devils better on a nightly basis, this would be a different conversation. But I think sometimes, especially in these situations, players get so blinded by the fact that they have to fight that that becomes their only focus, right? Instead of actually playing their position and trying to help their team win. I think dressing him is a step against winning. And I think being so narrowly focused on that will be as well. And it's going to be tricky for Rempe to navigate as well. I think we see in some games him be so focused on going for a hit instead of the puck that I think it was against the Flyers, right? There was so much talk about how players were shying away from him behind the net. And it's not because they're afraid of him, but like when this guy is coming at you and you can see his pure focus is hitting, like you need to protect yourself and also keep your eye on the puck instead of, you know, the player coming at you. So I think the situation just has dragged out a little bit too long. I get it. I get why the Devils are mad. They should be. Absolutely. Every day of the week. But it just feels like it's, I can't say it's hard for me to sit here and say it's over with. Right. I'm not the one that got hit in the head. I would get it if I were upset or my teammates were anything like that. But I think it's just a long drawn out situation. If I were the Devils, I would just want to play my strengths, which would be my speed game, and skate circles around the Rangers and try to beat them because these are important points still.
They are, even though, listen, New Jersey's out of it. Like, technically, they're not. I mean, the Pittsburgh Penguins are making noise now. Like, I'm going to ask you about the Pens here in a couple of seconds. But, like, New Jersey is out. And I think that, like, listen, there's a long history of, you know, taking a number. I'll get you back another game. Not going to do it this game. Like, that's sort of not that just because there's historical precedent that it has to continue. But I just, considering the way that the season has gone for the New Jersey Devils, I think that there would be a significant part of that fan base that if they don't get the pound of Matt Rempe flesh, they're really going to sort of double down on how disappointing a season this was. Because, you know, Rangers are going to the playoffs. Rangers, you know, may win the Stanley Cup. Rangers are one of the elite teams in the NHL. And there's Matt Rempe still skating freely while they're done after game 82. There's no game 83 for them. Do you think that factors into any of it, that there's a part of the fan base that needs to see this? Or is this just players settling it themselves? What goes into this one, you think?
A little bit of both, right? I mean, listen, if you're a Devils fan and you're sitting there saying, well, that's the reason you're not in the playoffs, like, you got bigger problems there. And I'd be focusing on that. I'd want to see a nice bounce back game from Jake Allen, or, you know, let's see what Kokkonen can do. And I would want to see, you know, the defense look a little bit more stout, everybody stay healthy. I'd want to see Jack Hughes flying around the ice. Like, that would be what I would want to see. You know, this is a team you took out in round one, and remind them that that's who you can be. But I'm sure that there's that mentality too, because, you know, sometimes it's like grasping at straws when you have a season as disappointing as the Devils, it feels like. So if you can find those small victories, and this might be something that they view as one, and, you know, I get it, it does make sense.
Okay, let me, that's one of five games on the go around the NHL this evening. Tampa faces off Toronto with a single point. The Maple Leafs can claim a playoff spot. The battle for third in the Atlantic, if the Tampa Bay Lightning end up winning this one. I mentioned off the top, Vancouver needs this game against the Arizona Coyotes tonight after really laying an egg against Vegas last night. Edmonton, Dallas, Tanev looks like he's in the lineup tonight, so that's good to go for Dallas. Seattle, Los Angeles, and as we just mentioned, the New Jersey Devils face off against the New York Rangers. So let me ask you about the Selke Trophy. So I was on with J.D. Bunkus this morning. We had a conversation about the Selke Trophy and various players like Austin Matthews, for example, and Mitch Marner, for example. Now that Patrice Bergeron has left, the field opens because, as you know, for the longest time, the race for the Selke Trophy was always the race for runner-up. Like, that was the important race. Like, who's going to be the first loser to Patrice Bergeron who's going to claim this thing? And I bring this up knowing full well, whenever you and I talk about the Selke Trophy, you're always quick to point out something that I think we should all keep in the front of our minds. And that is, are you voting for the best defensive forward or the best two-way forward? And I think it's different depending on who you ask, but it seems more than ever now, the voting is towards the best two-way forward, even though the award was created specifically for Bob Gainey, who I don't want to say was the enemy of point production, but point production was very secondary to Bob Gainey's game. Anyhow, a thought on where we're at with the Selke right now. I know this is one that you take a lot of pride in researching.
Yeah, it's always interesting how it's viewed. And, you know, that does make awards interesting in the first place, right? It's subjective. You can decide how it should be interpreted, how you see fit. In today's game, it definitely does slant towards more of two-way play. If not, we would have seen guys like Noah Cates and Jordan Staal round out the ballot instead of more hype for guys like Nico Hischier and Anze Kopitar. And it's not that you can't be the best defensive player if you have points. That's not the case at all. If we look at it this year, I would say Alexander Barkov is the favorite for this award, and he is the best defensive player, and he also has a ton of points. He happens to be the best two-way player. He kind of, you know, it's a one-size-fits-all, and sometimes it's that case when it was with, you know, Patrice Bergeron. But I think that we have to think about defense differently, and that's the whole thing, right? This is the one, I think, besides goaltending, which is like another issue of its own, but defense is something that's really hard to define. in today's game. We don't have a ton of metrics. If you ask someone, a more traditionalist, let's say, you know, what they look at for defense, they might say it's average time on ice, it's shot blocks, and it's usage. Are they on the penalty kill? Are they out to defend an empty net goal? And I think that's all important to be on there. But we also need to think about what defense looks like in today's speed, skill, and scoring game. That might be making the defensive play in the offensive zone to extend time. It might be a really good forechecker. It might be being great at puck retrievals. It might be zone exits. It might be any of those little things combined. So when we start talking about that, we have to look at possession numbers too, because if you possess the puck, say 65% of the time, you're not defending. Yeah. We don't need to, you know, we're measuring defense in a different way. It's a proactive defense. We can't, you know, measure something that never happened at all. But if you're stopping opponents from ever getting the chance to create shots against, that counts for something too. And that's what's going to get guys like Austin Matthews a little bit of hype this year, rightfully so. And then you get into a different conversation. Like, once you get to that level of who's good defensively, then I think you have to start breaking out like the subcategories. Who's really good on the penalty kill? Who kills penalties at all? Should they even kill penalties? Is it a waste of someone like Austin Matthews' time? And you would say, yeah, probably, you know, and then there's even more that you can just keep unpeeling to get to the root of who should be the award winner or at least the finalist.
How do you feel about it?
I would go Barkov number one. I think that there is a bias towards center, and sometimes rightfully so, because there's a little bit more defense to it. But I do have a guy like Sam Reinhart up there, and this is where it gets really tricky, because that's a duo of players that plays together all the time. They play together at five on five all the time, on the penalty kill, in those six on five situations. They are put out to help hold a lead or defend a lead. But I think Reinhart has had some really good defensive metrics that he deserves a nod, even if it is heavily influenced by Barkov, because it's not like this is a one-off thing for him. I would have Jordan Staal up there for sure. I know he's not scoring a ton, but oh my God, is he a great shutdown player? I think those are the guys that are going to get a lot of hype, and rightfully so. I think Kopitar is still doing it. You can get into then the conversation of, is he sharing the workload too much? And, you know, with someone like Deneau, and that's, you know, something else you have to analyze as you go. But I would still have Barkov number one this year.
It is fascinating too, the discussion around penalty kills. Oh, you know what I wanted to get? Actually, you know what? Park the part about penalty kills. I was always told by people in the analytics community who end up working for teams, not to put too much stock in takeaways, and things like, you know, face-offs, things that we look at and we say, okay, when we're looking at the Selke Trophy, these are some of the important things, right? I mean, someone forcing change of possession, that's good, right? Winning a face-off, someone that starts a chain of possession, that's good, right? How much stock do you put in takeaways and face-offs when you look at things like the Selke?
Face-offs, I don't put that much in. You know, the power of face-off gets overblown in the NHL. In women's hockey, it does have a stronger effect, and that was based on NWHL and PHF data, and the contact rules are different, because if you can't hit a player to change possession, you know, you can see why a face-off would be more effective in leading to a shot versus in the NHL. But I think sometimes it gets overblown, because someone might lose a faceoff, but I want to know what they do in the 5 seconds after that faceoff, or how they get possession back, because that right there could be everything to make strong defensive plays to shift to offense. The other part, takeaways, is really tricky because of how the NHL tracks them. There's a lot of inconsistencies. I wish we had a pure takeaway number and a pure giveaway number, but we don't. So it's tough to look at that on the surface and rely too heavily on it. Do I think things like stick checks are important in counting? Absolutely. And, you know, shot blocks or blocked passes are going to be important with it too. But I think we have to be a little bit more careful with how takeaways are tracked before we jump into what data we're handed by our lovely league.
What data were handed by our lovely league? Let me ask you really, really quickly here about, and this is on your last podcast. Now, mind you, this is the last one I listened to. I don't know if you have done ones subsequent. The last one, which is right after the general manager meetings in Florida. One of the things that you and Allison and Sarah talked about was, and I think you referred to it as like the Ovechkin leg rule or something like that. The idea of, you know, penalties being called after a warning when a player has his leg over the boards. Obviously, you know, we've seen officials get cut that way, and it's super dangerous. The one thing that I always keep going back and forth on, and there's, like, I don't know if there's any real great answer to this other than it's all dangerous. On the one hand, I don't like the idea of everybody changing by jumping over the boards, because I don't like the idea of that many skates in the air on a consistent basis. Having said that, I'm not really a big fan of opening and closing gates while the action is going on. If you want to talk about players and the potential to really maim someone, that's the way you do it, which is one of the reasons why I hate the too many men on the ice call, where there's a scramble in front of the bench and the other team just throws the puck at the bench and it hits the player and up, too many men, and everyone freaks out and they end up going to the box. So it's an imperfect way to switch players. Sorry, it's a dangerous way both ways to switch players. My failing in my job is I can't think of another way to get players on and off the ice. But when you look at either jumping over the boards or opening up the gates to have players go in and out, and we've seen players get hit into board into the gate before, and it's dangerous and no one likes to see it. Do you have a preference? Is one like less dangerous to you? Do you care either way, Shayna Goldman?
I can't believe you said that you don't like a certain type of too many men call. All too many men calls are good. We need all of the too many men all the time. And this is going to take away from my favorite penalty. You know what? I think I lean towards not opening the gate. That's one. When you see hits near that with the gate open, that is instantly anxiety inducing, in my opinion. I rather players jump over the boards. I agree with you about so many skates in the air. I think the one like thing that you can take solace in is when you see a full line change like that, generally speaking, it's the players dump the puck in or someone's holding it behind the net. And it feels like you have like that quick reset, that there's not going to be as much contact by the board. So I think you lessen the chance of something happening. And it's just about awareness for the players on the bench and going over the boards. But I feel like that is somehow, despite a million knives in the air and players' faces right there, that is the safer method.
Yeah. Before I let you go, quick thought on the Pittsburgh Penguins. Are they really in this thing, or is Sidney Crosby just trying to, you know, lug this squad up to the top of a mountain?
Well, he's been trying to do that all year. Let's be real. He's been outstanding since day one of the season. Their most valuable player would have a case for MVP if that was a playoff team. And if the field wasn't so deep this year. Are they good? Well, yes and no. Their 5-on-5 play has gotten better over this last stretch, so credit to them there. And now they're getting a little bit more puck luck, which they haven't had. You can see how they're finishing their chances, and they're getting saves from Nedeljkovic, which definitely helps, obviously, if you aren't being set back by, you know, not failing to convert or failing to get saves. The problem is there's one area of their game that has been terrible from day one, and they still have no answer for it, and that is their power play. The power play numbers are still terrible. It's honestly almost unexplainable how a unit with so much talent could be so bad for this long. It just is stagnant, and I think that's going to hold them back. You can obviously have success without a power play. We saw it before with the 2011 Bruins. Their power play wasn't great, but they were elite in every single other category that I think you can kind of try to balance out your weaknesses, and I don't think the Penguins are strong enough. But, I mean, they're still in it, and they're in it because of their surroundings in the Eastern Conference, of nobody else wanting that spot. It's going to be really interesting, though, and there are some really big games to end the year, because Pittsburgh, you know, matches up against Washington, I think, and Detroit, and you have Philly and Washington going head-to-head. You have the Islanders playing Washington one more time. Like, there's so many good matchups that it's really going to make things interesting, and all these big games could somehow shake out in the Penguins' favor, unlike last year. But there's still some kinks to work out to be a legit round one threat, and I don't know if they'll ever get to that level this year.
It's going to feel like it's like, I don't know, 2009 or 2008 tomorrow, when we're all getting excited about Crosby and Ovechkin again in a game that has meaning this deep into the schedule. But there it is, Pittsburgh and Washington. Here we go. This is like right out of the lockout, 87 versus the Great Eight. It's Pittsburgh versus Washington again, 19 seasons later. We'll start talking about these two and these two teams. Shayna, you're the best. Thanks as always for stopping by. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon and enjoy the Rangers and the Devils and the sidebar of Curtis McDermott and Matt Rempe.
Sorry, my game to watch is Dallas Edmonton tonight, but thank you for having me.
It's the great Shayna Goldman from the Too Many Men podcast and a writer with The Athletic as well. We'll hit a break. We're going to come back with Carolina Hurricanes general manager Don Waddell. Plenty on the Hurricanes. Should probably get a thought or two from Don Waddell on the future of Atlanta. Three times a charm. We'll ask Don Waddell that in a couple of moments. Greg Wyshynski, top of the hour as well. Merrick Show continues across the Sportsnet Radio Network, simulcast on Sportsnet 360, wherever you get your podcasts as well. We're back with Carolina General Manager Don Waddell. Don't go anywhere.
The most opinionated Maple Leaf show out there. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is the Jeff Merrick Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Welcome back to the program. Well, if you listen or watch this program on a consistent basis, you know one of the topics we love discussing are the Carolina Hurricanes. Hurricanes are a team that seem to right now have really hit their stride and have a big game tomorrow against the Boston Bruins. Always love watching these two rivals meet up, either in the regular season or the playoffs. Don Waddell is the GM of the Carolina Hurricanes. He joins me now. Don, how are you today? Thanks so much for doing this.
I'm excellent, Jeff. How are you making out?
I'm doing well, and I think we're all enjoying watching your Carolina Hurricanes, who seem to have really, and it's not just recent, it's, you know, the last couple of months specifically, really hit the stride that we thought Carolina was going to hit at some point. We'll open sort of big picture here. Can you give us, from your point of view, a snapshot of where you see your team right now, today, in advance of the game tomorrow against the Bruins?
Well, we like how we're playing. Obviously, start of the year probably a little slower than we all wanted to, and then about December we kicked it in gear, and particularly, like you said, the last couple of months we've gone very well. We've gotten great performances from our goalie, and we're scoring goals, and you know, everybody needs to score goals to win hockey games. So the combination of playing good defense, getting good goaltending, and scoring some timely goals has put us in this position where we feel good moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seemed as if, you know, heading into the season and coming out of last year's postseason, the one thing that we wondered about was, okay, what are the Carolina Hurricanes going to do about getting more goals? And there is, you know, keeping Svechnikov healthy is certainly one of those things. And then with the acquisitions you made at trade deadline, whether it's Gensel, whether it's Kuznetsov, like, was this sort of in the back of your mind all season long? You know, the health is going to sort itself out here, and, you know, you cross your fingers and hope that everyone's healthy come playoff time. But in your mind, was, you know, job number one, getting more goal scoring in this lineup?
Yeah, 100%. You know, we went through it last year. You know, we lost the conference finals to Florida. They scored 10 goals. We scored 6. And you could say we didn't have Svechnikov, but, you know, everybody's going to have some injuries. So we said we went into the trade deadline. And, you know, the trade deadline, you know, everybody talks about the last few days, but it starts obviously weeks before that. And then the common thing for us was we were looking for guys that had playoff experience and playoff success. We liked our team. We weren't just going to make changes for the sake of making changes. But when these two players became available and we were able to acquire them, if you look at Jake, I think he's got 58 playoff games, 58 points, and 34 goals. We all know it's hard to score in the playoffs. And Kuzi's got good playoff numbers, mm-hmm. too, including the run in 17 when they won the Stanley Cup. So, you know, yeah, we weren't just out there looking for a player particular as much as we were looking for someone that has done it in the playoffs.
You know, the last couple of days here on this show, even going back to last couple of weeks, really, I've been having these conversations about the most improved player in the NHL. Personally, I'd like to see that as an award, but that seems to have fallen on deaf ears. But I'm going to still bang the drum anyhow. And when it comes to most improved player, and we're talking about this specifically the last couple of days, a couple of names come to mind. Quinton Byfield with the Los Angeles Kings, Yuri Slafkovsky of the Montreal Canadiens, Thomas Harley with Dallas. He's done a great job as well on the back end. But the one that I keep coming back to is Seth Jarvis, who seems to have taken not just a step, but a leap in his development. Great personality, wonderful hockey player. What does the general manager see in Seth Jarvis? And is he, for you, the most improved player in the game?
Yeah, well, all the names you mentioned are great names, and all have had great seasons. You know, I guess when I look at it, I don't know if I look at it as the most improved. I guess we saw it come in the last couple of years, and I'm not surprised he's taking that next step. You know, obviously he's a player that's got good hockey instincts. He's small frame, but as we all know, he's not afraid at all. He's the first one to go in the corner and get a puck. Obviously getting the chance with playing with Aho, and now Gensel's a bigger bonus. But even before Gensel got here, he was having success. So Seth, you know, he started killing penalties. So he plays both special teams for us along with 5-on-5. I can't say there's nothing negative I can say about Seth Jarvis's game at this point, and I believe he's only going to get better.
Let me ask you about one more player in conversation here with Don Waddell, general manager of the Carolina Hurricanes. Let me ask you about Jordan Staal. We were just having a conversation with Shana Goldman before you came on, and her and I were chatting about various candidates for the Selke Trophy, and listen, Barkov's name is going to be bandied about. Austin Matthews is making some noise. Reinhardt's in the conversation as well with the Florida Panthers, but Jordan Staal has to be considered right there, and it shouldn't come as any surprise to anyone. I'm sure it doesn't come as a surprise to you, but you know, is it finally, do you think, going to be Jordan Staal's time to get the attention he deserves as far as being a two-way player and a candidate legit for the Selke Trophy?
Well, if I had a vote, I'd vote twice for him, because I watch it every night. You know, he plays against he gets the toughest matchups every single night. Yep. Even when we're on the road, you know, there's always a quick change, and he's out there. He takes every important face-off for us, even offensively when we're down by a goal. So, again, another player that you mentioned, true great leader. You know, he's not a real yeller and screamer. He's a leader by example. He's what he's accomplished this year, I think, you know, forget about goals and assists, because that's how most forwards get measured. We measure him by his impact in the game, and every night he's got an impact for us in every hockey game.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting too, you know, we tend to think of 35, it's like, oh boy, okay, so that's that's pretty close to shutting it down time for NHLers, and here's Jordan Staal at 35 years of age, you know, still in consideration for one of the more significant trophies in the NHL. Do you have a thought on Jordan Staal just not slowing down?
Well, you know, I think it all starts with your preparation and how you prepare for the season. And, you know, every year when he comes to training camp, you know, he's one of our better fit athletes. You know, our two of our top three, four guys were him and Burns, and Burns a little bit older. So I think that's got to be the first recognition that, you know, he approaches the season like a good pro would. You know, he comes in here always here at least 6-8 weeks before the start of training camp, and is working out with our strength and conditioning coaches. And when we step on the ice for training camp, we knew and know he's always going to be ready to play. So, you know, and he's a true pro. After a game, doesn't matter if he plays 16 minutes or 20 minutes, you know, he's in there doing his workouts. You know, he doesn't take any shortcuts, and that's why he's having success at age 35, is because, you know, he's committed to be a pro, and he wants to be a pro for a long time to come.
Let me ask you about an issue that's kind of come out since the general manager meetings in Florida, and that's the e-bug issue. Now, outside of Lester Patrick with the New York Rangers, I mean, your Carolina Hurricanes kind of have the most famous e-bug of all time in David Ayers. I know there are some managers that maybe don't want it changed. Some perhaps do want it changed. I've talked to managers who said, like, listen, we don't, you know, I've never seen a lawyer come out of the stands to, you know, to take over for a quarterback in the NFL. Why do we allow something similar to happen with goaltenders in the NHL? How much of a discussion was the e-bug at the general manager's meeting? I understand there may be some sort of takeaways and teams and managers trying to come up with alternative solutions to the e-bug. But how much noise did the e-bug issue get at the GM's meetings?
Well, it got some attention. We break out in smaller groups, and it was in my group that we had that one. You know, we look back, and it's happened so infrequently. So when it happens, nobody likes it. But how much of a change do you make? You know, we talked about, you know, trying to carry a third goalie, you know, the cost of that, and, you know, obviously the CBA issues and all that with that. So I think we're all looking for solutions for it, but it's not as easy as just saying this is what we can do, because obviously there's a couple sides that have to agree on it, you know, and then how infrequent it happens. You know, if there's things we need to talk about, certainly this is one, but it's not at the top of the list.
Gotcha. Let me ask you about something that we've been sort of, you know, banding about the last little while and speculating on for a number of years now, really. And that is Atlanta. The idea of another Atlanta franchise in the NHL. We've seen the Flames, we've seen your Thrashers, and potentially we could see another Atlanta team in the National Hockey League. You are very uniquely qualified to talk about this as a former GM of the Atlanta Thrashers. What was the market? Like, we all know how it fell apart in the ownership and throwing the keys on the table, but can you describe for us what the Atlanta hockey market was when you were there and when the Thrashers left, and maybe any observations you've had since the Thrashers left Atlanta?
Yeah, you know, like anything, when you start there, we started there in 99 playing and got there in 98. You know, we really dug our heels into the grassroots program at the time. There's only two facilities in the whole marketplace for youth, and now there's nine because my grandson plays down there, and so I'm familiar with it. A couple things they have going for them. You know, the thing for us was we had a couple good years of run there, and then we just... You know, it was. We all know the story. You know, we had the ownership that owned the Hawks and the Thrashers, yep. And you know they're more basketball people than hockey people, so that's fine. You know, we dealt with it. But to say that Atlanta should not have an NHL team, you know, that's going to be up to obviously the commission, the board of governors. What I would say is, you know, everything I've heard and just what I read and hear about. The Braves moved out of the city, went north, and they've hit the home run with it, literally. And, you know, from everything I've read, they're talking about building a potential arena north of the city. And we used to do our surveys for our season ticket holders. It was almost 80% of the season ticket holders came from the north. So I think if somebody's thinking that way, they're, in my opinion only, that they're thinking the right way of trying to build a building. You know, outside of downtown and, you know, see if they can make it work. Obviously, it's going to take building a building and, you know, money to do that and buy a franchise. But and it is still, I think, the seventh or eighth largest TV market, which is always an interest for us in the NHL.
Certainly. And TNT is anchored there. It would make some sense, obviously, to have a hockey team there. Last question for Atlanta. When you look back at your time with the Thrashers, what are your main memories? Like, what do you take away from your time in Atlanta?
Well, first of all, I worked with good people along the way. You know, I had a lot of people that have done well that have been there. You know, I had Andrew Burnett there as a player. I've had a lot of guys there that have come out of there and done well in different roles. But, you know, it was good to me and my family there. It really was. I have a lot of good friends that are still there. I still believe that if we were in a different situation that we would have been fine and made it there. Yep. But I still get to visit, like I said, the region because my daughter and grandkids live there. so I do have a little bit of a soft spot in my heart for Atlanta and the surrounding area.
You know, at this time of year, we're seeing a lot of, you know, college players signing NHL contracts. I think with Carolina, we wonder about someone who had a really good year at Maine, Bradley Nadeau, who was your first round pick, 30th overall. Is he close, do you think, or is he bound to return?
Well, you know, that's a decision he'll have to make, but we think he's close. We think, you know, he's had a tremendous college career and, you know, he's going to make a decision if he's going to, what he's going to do. And, you know, if he makes a decision to stay in school, we'll support it. If he makes a decision to turn pro, we'll obviously love to sign him.
This has been great. Listen, Don, you're always candid. We always appreciate it here. Thank you so much for stopping by and sharing thoughts on your team, a couple of your players, Atlanta, and maybe the future in Bradley Nadeau. Thanks, as always, for stopping by. Good luck against the Bruins, and good luck the rest of the way.
All right, Jeff. Always a pleasure to be with you.
There he is, Don Waddell, the general manager of the Carolina Hurricanes, commenting on a few things. And interestingly enough as well, the e-bug situation. Not all managers like it. I would make the argument that the majority, if not all, managers look at this one and say, maybe there's a better way to do this. You know, if we don't want to put a player in the pads, if there's a couple of injuries here, how do we go about it if we don't go the E-Bug route? And I believe the last position player to go in, we have to go all the way back to 1961, Jerry Tappazzini in a Chicago-Boston game. And it was only for a few minutes towards the end of the game that the topper went in. But there are a lot of general managers that are, you know, have this, even though, as Don Waddell mentioned, it's not a top agenda item for them. There's a lot of other things to get to, but make no mistake about it, in the back of everyone's mind here is how do we make this situation more palatable? And again, if you're adding players, it becomes a CBA issue and who pays, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So probably this thing doesn't get settled anytime soon, but it is a conversation that managers continue to have, and we'll stay on top of that one here on the program, to say nothing of our website and all of our social media channels. Matt Marchese, before we get to sports interaction here in a couple of seconds, where are you right now with the Carolina Hurricanes? I mean, this team is hitting their stride. Like, this is a team that you look at, and I know that everybody in the West looks like killers, especially Vegas right now, but you know, they are one of the teams that I don't think anybody wants a piece of right now in the East.
No, it's going to come down to goaltending with them, right? Everything else is fine. Like, you look at the defensive unit, you look at the forwards, you say, that's good. Are they going to get the goaltending that's going to get them through? That's going to be the big question. And who is going to be the guy? It's probably, you know, we've seen it in the playoffs, it's probably not going to be one guy, but is somebody going to be able to take the reins here, whether it be Kochetkov, whether it be Anderson? The story is well told on Frederik Anderson and his lack of playoff success. We've seen it in Toronto. Kochetkov is kind of the wild card here. We'll see what happens. But that's what it comes down for me. They're well coached. They play a really good – they play a style that is conducive to winning in the playoffs. They have depth at all positions. If they can get goaltending, they can win a Stanley Cup. If they don't, I just don't see the path here.
I think they're frighteningly good, and it's been for, you know, it's been so long here. Like, I'm not saying that it's approaching San Jose Shark territory, because for the longest time, this is back in the Thornton Marlowe era. How many times did you bite? Because I bit on it almost every single season. This is the year the San Jose Sharks win the Cup. This is the year they finally put it together. Okay, they've made these final touches here. All of a sudden, now the San Jose Sharks are ready to win. And they never did. Mm-hmm. And they go down in history as one of the best teams ever to not win the Stanley Cup. Kind of like, you know, a couple of those Ottawa Senators teams that were stacked for so many years and for various reasons, whether it's, you know, running into the Buffalo Sabres or Joe Nieuwendyk knuckleballs. They were never able to get there and never able to finally put it together. But Carolina's, they're getting to that, okay, now it's really time to do something territory. Maybe this is the year. Like, if you think everybody in the West is going to beat each other up, and whoever comes out of the West is going to be beaten up and maybe easier pickings than other seasons, and you might be able to coast your way to a cup, maybe this is the year to do it. Just got to get out of the Eastern Conference. Okay, time now for Line Change, presented by Sports Interaction, your homegrown sports book. Bet local. What are you thinking about tonight on the five-game schedule around the NHL tonight, Maddie?
I'm doing that thing where I'm a sucker for the late games, apparently, again. But this is the marquee matchup of the night for me. It's the Oilers at the Stars. The puck line is Stars -1.5. Edmonton is 4-2 straight up in their last six in Dallas. The over has hit in six of the last seven between these two teams. And, of course, the Dallas Stars riding a 7-game rip right now.
Yeah, they're really good. And the Oilers coming off a 3-2 loss against the St. Louis Blues on Monday. You know, one person that probably doesn't get enough attention around the Edmonton Oilers is defenseman Evan Bouchard. Like, look, he's not Cale Makar, he's not Quinn Hughes, and he's not going to win the Norris Trophy, but he's tied with Roman Josi for third for points from a defenseman. And, you know, Sean McIndoe on The Athletic has a really nice piece, and I encourage you all to read it, about what it means for Connor McDavid, who's now 3 points away from recording 100 assists. Only three other players have done that. Their names are Wayne Gretzky, Mario Lemieux, and Bobby Orr. As you mentioned, Stars have won 7 games in a row. Looks like Chris Tanev is in. I mean, we all held our breath in that game against Seattle where he got elbowed by Adam Larson and left. So we will look forward to that. And this is a really balanced lineup full of 20 goal scorers. We know they have goaltending issues, but elsewhere there are no seeming flaws in the Dallas Stars game. Pete DeBoer, candidate for coach of the year? What do you think? That's Line Change, presented by Sports Interaction, your homegrown sports book. Bet local. Greg Wyshynski from ESPN and The Drop is next across the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360, wherever you get your podcasts. It's the Merrick Show. Back in a moment.
Covering the Blue Jays from an analytical perspective, Jays Talk Plus with Blake Murphy. Be sure to subscribe and download Jays Talk on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is the Jeff Merrick Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Welcome back to the program. Matt Marchese aboard. And Maddie, just on the break there, listen to about 5 minutes of the John Tortorella Meet the Philadelphia Media presser with some really interesting stuff. And it's more of a laid-back setting. Tortorella is still quite passionate, as he is, but it's just more sort of lean back as opposed to right after a game where he's wound up and will fire off, etc. Do we have anything from that?
Oh, we sure do. We got about a minute 46 of it, and it's a great Tortorella clip. Okay. Where he doesn't back down on anything that he said from the other night. So let's hear it. Let's listen to John Tortorella from earlier today after practice.
It's not just the second period. As I watch the tape, to me, it's more than just the second period. And I don't worry about that. If a player or it always comes down to, right? It always comes down, oh, they're going to quit on him. It follows me around. And so be it. If a player is going to quit on me or players are going to quit on me because I'm trying to make them better people and better athletes, you got the wrong damn coach here. And you got the wrong damn people here. So I'm not sure what goes on. My job is I am going to push athletes. And I try to stay away from I have other things on my mind that I don't give you. I was in control the other night. What I said I meant. And quite honestly, when I watch the tape now, I'm more concerned than just the second period. Because of... I'm so proud of the team getting here. And I guess now the narrative out there is, because I've heard from other people, that they're young, they're not supposed to be here. Bull. We're here. We're here. Face it. And let's be better. And I don't think we're ready to be better. And that's my problem with us right now. And it is my job. I have not done a good enough job to get them over the hump after playing those seven games, and then each game as it goes down, we have six left. I haven't done a good enough job to make them understand we have to be different now. We have to be at a different level. That's my frustration with me, and that's my frustration with the team. And if people can't handle it, so be it.
Okay, ask John Tortorella. This was really interesting. And again, I listened to about 5 or 6 minutes of it. I just retweeted the whole thing. You can find it on my Twitter feed. It's fascinating because at points, like you just heard there, Maddie, he's quite passionate. And, you know, the second period that he's referring to is the game on Monday night, the overtime loss against the New York Islanders. And, you know, this saw, you know, Sammy Ersson get pulled. Ivan Fedotov comes in to make his NHL debut. In the second period specifically, this Philadelphia Flyers team got caved in. 17-3 were the shots in the second period. Tortorella in that clip talks about, and when he looked back at the tape, it was more than just the second period that he had concerns about. Some of the takeaways from what I've heard so far of this, and again, I haven't heard the whole thing. It's like 15 or 16 minutes, well worth listening to. The idea of, you know, I'm here to push athletes. I'm here to remind them that at this time of the year, given where we are right now, we need to be different. We need to be better, et cetera, et cetera. And then he dives on the grenade and says, it's my fault that I haven't been able to get them to that place. John Tortorella is too smart of a coach for that not to be a tactic. And as much as he's talking to reporters and assembled media and by extension fans that are watching this, he's talking to his team at that point. And he's making himself part of all of this. And he's not saying, I'm standing outside of this. I'm standing there with this team These failures are my failures as well. You know, you've all seen coaches. Maddie, I'm sure you've had coaches like this. We win, you lose. And I think Tortorella is going out of his way, as much as he talks about not losing the room and not losing players, etc., to make sure that they understand that this is all one unit. This is his job. And if it's not happening, he takes some responsibility for it as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's why I think Torts is so, he's such a good coach. And I like how he pointed out, like, you know, the narrative surrounding me is I pushed players too hard. But I like that he brought up, like, I'm here to make people better. I'm here to make them better people. I'm here to make them better players. And I think that is the job, especially for this group of players in Philadelphia, which it is a younger group. And they weren't supposed to be here. You're right. But we're here, so we might as well make the most of it. And I think John Tortorella is brilliant. And that's why it's funny that for the longest time, you know, prior to the Flyers actually starting, because I remember when he got hired and everybody went, oh boy, like how's this going to work with Philadelphia? I mean, yeah, he screams Philadelphia, but with that group, does he really scream right now? And when they started, they've certainly played. Last year was obviously a struggle, but this year punched above their weight class for sure. And he's gotten the most out of this group. Something is working here, Jeff. Like, he's clearly gotten through to these players and has had success in a year that everyone thought that they weren't going to be good. There is Flyer fans didn't think they were going to be good. And if they say that they thought that way, they're liars. But John Tortorella has put it all on the table here. And I agree. He did jump on the grenade here. He did take the shot. And I like that.
Yes. Yeah. So one of the things that we mentioned off the top of the show today is how everybody is so shy about using the word rebuild and doesn't want to use the word soft either. And so we played that Rick Tocchet clip where instead of saying soft, he talked about being light.
Like, it's great.
Okay. Okay. But anyway, but the Philadelphia Flyers, Daniel Briere, Keith Jones, etc., Dan Hilferty, they've never been shy about saying we're rebuilding this thing. You know, and Briere said this from day one, not shy about using that word. And one of the things that we had wondered about, and I keep kind of going back and forth on this, was John Tortorella the right coach for a rebuild? And that's actually a compliment in that John Tortorella is not going to be your classic rebuild coach where, you know what, and it's more about roster than coaching, I suppose, but he's not going to sit by while the team piles up losses so they can have the best shot at getting Macklin Celebrini. For example, he wasn't going to be that guy. And the Philadelphia Flyers are not going to get Macklin Celebrini because of it. But then the flip side of that is, well, what are you starting to build here? And what type of accountability are you starting to build? And what kind of culture are you starting to build? And all the buzzwords we hear about how to build the dressing room and have a certain standard that everybody understands when you enter that dressing room. And one of the things that Tortorella has always done, and this is where I thought it was interesting on Monday night when he talked about we're gathering information, we're learning things, you know, learning about which players want to do this and which players don't, which players are going to bloom and which players are going to wilt. And that's what Tortorella does. Tortorella has always been a coach that puts players through tests. And I keep going back to the first example we saw of this, and that is Cam York, where everyone thought he was making the team out of training camp. And guess what? Even before training camp was done, he was playing with Lehigh Valley in the American Hockey League. And we all went, whoa, because like everybody else and probably Cam York himself, we all thought he was making the team.
Yeah.
And as much as he may not have made that team, there'd be a lot of teams that would say like, hey, that's a first round draft pick and it's his time to make this team. And he's starting this season on the roster. And as much as anything else, I think that that was a test from John Tortorella. And I think he puts other players through these tests as well. How are they going to respond when he calls them out publicly? How are they going to respond when he benches them? How is the team going to respond when the coach scratches Sean Couturier? Because I don't necessarily think that that was just about John Tortorella and Sean Couturier. I think part of what John Tortorella is doing with this group is saying, how is everybody going to react to this? You can say it's too much. You can say it's over the top. And I understand all of it. But I also do understand that they're trying to build something and where he might not be the best coach for a rebuild that gets you a lot of high picks, he's probably a really good coach for instilling accountability into that room. I think you can ask the question, will John Tortorella still be the coach when this team is ready to compete for the Stanley Cup? Discuss amongst yourselves. But as much as I used to go back and forth on the idea, is he the right coach for a rebuild? Is he not? Considering where Philadelphia is at right now, he's probably a really good coach for this, for that team with those players and that expectation.
Yeah.
Like, how about you?
Yeah, I agree. And the one thing that I will point out is how many players in John Tortorella's tenure in Philadelphia have gotten worse?
I can't think of any off the hop that have gotten worse.
I can think of some that have gotten better, though.
It's been sometimes there's been awkwardness with
sure.
Morgan Frost, but that's a really good hockey player, and I think he's gotten better this year
yep.
as well.
Joel Farabee, Owen Tippett, Travis
Sanheim. Farabee had the ADR surgery,
yep.
so I think that like, I look at last year and I just sort of throw that away and say that was a player that's coming off substantial surgery, and I kind of give that the mulligan year. But to me, Owen Tippett is the guy.
Yeah. Well, Farabee Owen career Tippett, high in points this year too, Jeff.
Well, he's coming up, and that's an excellent point. He's been given a lot of opportunities, and I think he had a lot to prove coming off a really soft season last year. But again, like when you come, and I would have like looked at Jack Eichel as well, coming off his ADR yeah. and Tyler Johnson, and said like, you know, I just like whenever a player has hip surgery, I always say I'm giving him a mulligan year right after that.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you have hip surgery, I kind of look at the year following hip surgery, especially for older players, and say, man, that's going to take a long time to really come back from. I give them the mulligan year, and I do the same thing with artificial disc replacement. I say, I'm going to throw that next year. I'm just going to crumple it up and throw it in the trash. That's what I looked at with Joel Farabee last year. Was it a bad year for Joel Farabee? Yes, for a number of reasons, and a lot of them I just circle back to that surgery, man. I'm going to give them the mulligan year. I mean, Owen Tippett's been great, though.
Yeah. Like,
Owen Tippett has been fantastic. And I think, you know, the secret is out, just how well everybody knew how hard he would shoot, for one. Like, that was even going back to his draft year. Like, everybody knew that, like, Owen Tippett in his draft year had the hardest, most accurate shot of anybody in his draft class. Now we know how good a player he is. And now we know how flat out fast he is.
Yeah.
A lot of this is you know, the training he does with Matt Nichol. He's so fast. And a lot of this is training he does with Matt Nichol. Matt Nichol can do a victory lap for this one as well. And he's worked with Owen. He worked with Owen Tippett, you know, going back years. But I think part of that is John Tortorella. And that's why I come back. And this was saying this to Wish a second ago. If you're a team like the Buffalo Sabres who are right there and are so close, that's the style of coach you need for those guys. And you know what? I think young players want that. As much as it's awkward sometimes, and as much as it might be, you know, rough, and you know, oh, the grumpy coach is going to get, you know, grumpy at me again. I think that young players want that and need that because they all want to be better. Everyone on that Buffalo Sabres team wants to be better. All those players do. Tage Thompson to the next captain, Rasmus Dahlin, all of them want to be better.
Mm-hmm.
Just like I think a lot of those Philadelphia Flyers players are the same way. But that's quite a press. I can't wait. As soon as the show goes off the air here, I'm going to listen to the remainder of that press conference. But, I mean, it's an extended conversation with assembled Philadelphia media with John Tortorella. So a few things for tonight. A lot of interesting matchups, ones that have some playoff ramifications. Matty, if the Toronto Maple Leafs pick up a single point, they will clinch a playoff spot officially. They'll face off against the Tampa Bay Lightning. Tampa is 6 points back of the Toronto Maple Leafs for third in the Atlantic. We talked about Rempe and McDermott, so we'll see what happens there. Between the Rangers and the New Jersey Devils, you had mentioned Dallas and Edmonton as well. I'm also curious to see the next installment of Shane Wright versus the NHL as Seattle faces off against the Los Angeles Kings. Vancouver and Arizona, considering what we saw last night from the Vancouver Canucks against the Vegas Golden Knights. And listen, Vegas is really good. No surprise there. But man, did the Vancouver Canucks lay an egg, bluntly. And that's why we got Rick Tocchet talking about taking things lightly. And we're a little bit too light out there. What's got your interest tonight? I mean, Edmonton, St. Louis, we talked about too.
Yeah.
Edmonton, Dallas, we talked about as well.
Yeah, I think the Edmonton, Dallas game, I think that's the marquee matchup for the night. A potential conference final matchup early. Like, that's how good these two teams are. It does look like, interestingly enough, it does look like Calvin Pickard's going to get the start tonight for the Oilers.
Okay.
And it sounds like that sets up Stuart Skinner for a Friday in Colorado and then Pickard again. So Pickard going to get two starts this week. And I know Stuart Skinner, you know, he's had a little bit of a speed wobble. But to me, that's very interesting that he's not getting the start tonight. I wouldn't read too much into it. It's just very interesting that he's and Calvin Pickard, if I'm not mistaken, he beat Dallas earlier this season. So maybe that's part of the conversation as well. But that's a really it's a really good matchup. You talked about Evan Bouchard. I actually got a note from somebody, Ali Kassam, who does a great job of reminding me of a lot of things on Twitter, and said Evan Bouchard has the most points among defensemen since the All-Star break. And I get lots of notes from Oilers fans that they get so frustrated with the way that Evan Bouchard plays defense. But when he puts up points, everybody's happy. And he's going to have another great offensive year. And I'm curious to see what the... I would love to know what the next Evan Bouchard contract looks like. That is one thing that I am very intrigued by.
Yes. A couple of things about this game as well. Let me throw a couple more things here. This is one of the most balanced lineups as far as offensive production you will see in the NHL.
Yep.
Now, the record for 20 goal scorers in a season is the Boston Bruins.
Yes.
77-78 when they had 11 20-goal scorers. And you look at the Dallas Stars, and again, this is a Pete DeBoer bench. He runs his bench really effectively. Everybody's in double digits up front in ice time. No one's in single digits. And here's your production. Jason Robertson, 27 goals. Roope Hintz, 28 goals. Joe Pavelski, 26 goals. Mason Marchment, 20 goals. Matt Duchene, 24 goals. Tyler Seguin, 22 goals. Wyatt Johnston, 29 goals. Jamie Benn, 18 goals. It is all really, really spread out. And we talk about, you know, depth scoring. And the Vancouver Canucks and their fans are having that conversation today. They've had that conversation for a while now. That third line with Wyatt Johnston, Logan Stankoven, and Jamie Benn looks really good.
Pretty good
and
third line.
All of a sudden, you look at it's a really good third line. Then you look at a fourth line where you have Radek Foxa, and playoffs are always where that guy stands up big. Sam Steele and Craig Smith.
Mm-hmm.
That is and again, everybody's getting ice time. No one's got like 6 minutes and 46 seconds at no. Like, the least amount of ice is Craig Smith at 10-13
on
his team. No one's in the 20s. No one's rocking like 21 or 22 minutes up front. Certainly on the back end, you know, Haskinen's getting 24 minutes and Thomas Harley's getting 20 and Esa Lindell is getting 20.24 minutes per night. But up front, this is one of the most balanced attacks that we've seen. Montgomery's always run with Montgomery. Pete DeBoer's always run it this way. And I think it's one of those reasons why Pete DeBoer should probably be in the conversation for the Jack Adams Trophy. So that's one of five games to watch tonight. The Dallas Stars facing off against the Edmonton Oilers, Dallas at home. Thanks to Greg Wyshynski for stopping by the program today. Don Waddell, Carolina Hurricanes president, and GM Shannon Goldman kicked off the fun. Thanks to Matt Marchese, Lance Kennedy, and Jen Rolnick. Back tomorrow, noon Eastern, 9 Pacific, across the Sportsnet Radio Network, simulcast on 360, and wherever you get your podcasts. We are back tomorrow. Enjoy the games tonight. See you tomorrow.